91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Today we visit with noted historian Dr. Paul George. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper here. For many years, Paul George has co-hosted our popular South Florida History Quiz, but today we'll chat about the rich stories of the beginnings of Broward County, the city of Miami, and its adjunct, Coconut Grove. The Grove predates the city of Miami, with early inhabitants hailing from the Bahamas. The city of Miami was created after Flagler's Railroad headed down the road, and many of the signees of the original city charter were African Americans. Broward County is named after renegade Governor Napoleon Bonaparte Broward, and Fort Lauderdale after a martyr of the Second Seminole War. That's next, after the news. And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. We certainly urge you to support the regional and local programs heard on your station. They give a distinct South Florida flavor for all of us to enjoy. Give us a call at 1-866-247-9576, or you can also pledge online. The easy way, it's probably faster, WLRNradio.org. Well, this hour we'll visit with a topical currents and South Florida mainstay. Of course, that would be Dr. Paul George. He's a history professor at Miami-Dade College and affiliated with History Miami. Thousands of people have taken his numerous walking, biking, and boat history tours. And, of course, you've heard him on our popular South Florida History Quiz programs. Paul, I think we've done about 50 of those.
We have.
It's 50 hours of history quizzes.
People still ask me about them, too, Joe.
Well, today we'll focus, it's not a quiz, we'll focus on the history of several communities. And welcome to you, Dr. Paul George. Let's start a little bit. We have many new residents who come to the area and probably don't know the history of Fort Lauderdale. It gets its name from a martyr of the Second Seminole War, correct?
It does. There was a Fort Lauderdale built, named for Major William Lauderdale, who was the commanding official or officer there in 1838 during the Second Seminole War. He brought a group of volunteers with him to the New River under instructions from a general and built this fort in the spring, and then they broke camp, vacated it by June of 1838, but the name endured since that time.
Now, Lauderdale came from Tennessee. He was affiliated with Andrew Jackson, who, of course, was the first territorial governor.
He was. He was close to Jackson. And again, Jackson was all about volunteers. Thus, the nickname of the Tennessee Volunteers comes from there. Lauderdale, on his way back to Tennessee, never made it back. He died in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, which was a very roundabout way, but that's where he was at the time of his death, after they had left Fort Lauderdale in the summer of 1838.
But he had been wounded.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, how about the early settlers of Fort Lauderdale in that area?
Joe, before the Second Seminole War, which broke out in 1835, there was a small group of people living along what was called the New River Community. And that comes from Spanish maps, Rio Nuevo, before they called it Fort Lauderdale. When the war came, it disrupted all of that, and the area became a no-man's land. The U.S. population census in 1890 finds nobody living in today's Fort Lauderdale, although there was a family on the beach, a keeper of the House of Refuge, and the census taker overlooked that. So there's hardly anybody living there. What really gives it its jump start is, in addition to the railroad coming through in 1896, Henry Flagler's FEC Railway, but even more importantly was the drainage of the Everglades, which began off of the South Fork of the New River in 1906.
And our pal Napoleon Bonaparte Broward.
Right, for whom the county, of course, is named. He was a great champion of drainage, and what drainage did was it brought, among other things, companies in to speculate in what they thought would be brand new real estate, former swampland. And Richard Bowles was one of these big speculators, and he sold a lot of land west of today's Fort Lauderdale, sight unseen, to buyers before it was drained, anticipating the drainage would move pretty smoothly and quickly. It didn't. So all of a sudden, in March of 1911, an estimated 4,000 purchasers of land from maps from salesmen out in Colorado, Nebraska, what have you, want to see their land. The company was under pressure to hold this, what they called a land drawing. And so they came down to Fort Lauderdale, which was unincorporated, had essentially four rooming houses, not enough room for 4,000 people. They set up tents in an area called Progreso, which is north of downtown Fort Lauderdale today, and that's where they stayed. Never saw their land. It was still underwater. I've always marveled they didn't riot. But the few people in the community that had businesses, the few people general, said, we got to do something in the event this happens again. We may need police. We need water. We need sewage removal. And so they incorporated on March 27, 1911, as a city. Excuse me, as a town. Very small community at that time. Maybe 300 people.
Now, of course, we're talking about recorded history here. How about the native peoples that were in that area?
Tequesta Indians, we believe, roamed that area, and we have much less archaeological evidence of them there than we do in Miami-Dade County. Roamed that area as far back as at least a few thousand years ago. We do have enough traces of evidence, artifactual or otherwise, to indicate that they were up there, too.
Now, I've been on tours of Fort Lauderdale with you, Paul, and I was always impressed by you described how unique the New River is. What's unique about the New River?
Well, it's so unique. It's about 9 miles in length. One of the early inlets came off of today's Sheridan Boulevard in Hollywood, which means it would run west from the Atlantic and then north in what was then called New River Sound. Today it's part of the Atlantic Intracoastal Waterway. And then it would turn west when it got just west of today's Fort Lauderdale Beach and then head straight west. And then there were two forks. And one fork goes under I-95, and the other kind of trickles out under I-95, but it's subterranean at that point, around Lauderdale Lakes. It's unique because it's a small stream, not real wide, not real long, but in some parts it's more than 100 feet in depth. That's what makes it unique for me.
That's probably the deepest river in Florida, then, isn't it?
It probably is, and it's probably, in Ripley's Believe It or Not, in the late 1930s, and that was a favorite so-called comic strip, they looked at that uniqueness and said it's probably the deepest river for its length of any river around, at least in the United States.
And the story of the Stranahans.
Well, it's a great story. Frank Stranahan came from Ohio, had some respiratory problems, has kind of a dead-end job as a clerk in Melbourne, Florida, which was tiny. Has a very ambitious cousin down in southeast Florida, a guy named Guy Metcalf, who's building a road between the New River, the southern shores of Lake Worth down to Lemon City at Lemon Avenue, which is today 61st Street in Miami, east of the boulevard. There was no boulevard then. And when he built the road, the first major road, at least in that era, he was going to run a stage line over it called the Bay Biscayne Stage Line. He needed somebody to operate an overnight camp for travelers who would come up to the New River either coming from the south or from the north. And he summoned his cousin, Frank Stranahan. Stranahan said, I'd be happy to do it. Shows up in Fort Lauderdale one late January day in 1893, and he sleeps. Here's a guy from northern Ohio. He sleeps outside that night. This is late January. He's sleeping outside. He's awakened. He hears some noise, and he gets up, and maybe a couple hundred feet north of him were some Seminole Indians sitting around a campfire talking. He knew he'd arrived. So that was his introduction, and he became, a big landowner, a benefactor, a banker, a commissioner, really the father of modern Fort Lauderdale. He married his lovely wife, much younger than he, teacher, who had come from Live Oak and many other parts of northern Florida, ends up with her family down in Lemon City. And she passes a battery of exams up in northeast Florida to become a teacher, takes the train, the Florida East Coast Railway, from the Lemon City Depot around 59th Street, takes it up to Fort Lauderdale in 1899 to begin the school year. That would be around September of 1899. And they met. He would deliver her mail for her. The mail came to his, sort of like a trading post he had. And they met, and she was 18 or 19. He was 36. They courted and married. In those days, of course, a woman who married could not teach school. So her formal teaching was 1 year, the 1899-1900 school year.
Now, Frank Stranahan and his famous demise.
It's interesting because as long as Ivy lived, he committed suicide. He jumped into the New River from his house. Their house, the Stranahan House, which is a magnificent structure in Broward, still standing.
Right on the water.
Right on the water. North Bank, just on the edge of the median part of Los Olas Boulevard, next to, there's a hotel there, the Riverside Hotel, and there's some stores there. He put some iron grates around his legs. He had suffered from clinical depression, and he kind of put them in a wheelbarrow and kind of hobbled up to the river in 1929. Did that so he would stay down, jumped in. People saw him from across the river, dove in trying to rescue him, but they couldn't get him up in time. Funeral was a big affair in Lauderdale. They was very depressed then economically, the city. The bust is over in Miami and Florida at that time. A lot of Seminole Indians were out there too. They were friends of the Seminoles. But one of the agreements was that the, and it was the headlines of the newspaper when it happened, that it wouldn't be mentioned again in the public venue as long as Ivy lived. And she lived until 1971. She died at the outset of her 90s.
Wow.
And there was even a history of Fort Lauderdale that came out in 1966, just talks about the death of Frank Strand. It doesn't describe what happened. But once she passes away, it becomes public stuff.
Well, we're getting history tidbits, South Florida history tidbits, from our good friend Dr. Paul George. We're going to take a short pledge break. We'll be back with more.
Shine on my love and me, so we can stroll beside the roll of the rolling sea.
Ray Charles, of course.
Moon over Miami. Shine on us.
Makes you want to just kind of stretch out and relax on the veranda.
Just take it easy.
Yeah, yeah. We're talking with Dr. Paul George. We're doing our impromptu South Florida history tidbits with him, and we're going to turn to the city of Miami. Paul, of course, had a big native population here, as our Miami Circle certainly indicates, yes, and some of the new digs and things, but let's talk about the founding mothers of the city. And I think Miami is probably the largest city that actually has a female founder.
It really does. And Julia Tuttle's the most important of the founding moms, but there's also Mary Brickell. And then if you go down the road, there's Isabella Peacock and Coconut right. Grove, which becomes part of Miami in 1925. It's a city that went from nowhere to somewhere very quickly. You had one family on the river in 1890, the Brickells, on the South Bank. You had two families on the river in 1895, according to the Florida State Census. Julia Tuttle, who had now moved down from Ohio, on the North Bank, the Brickells. And Julia was determined to develop a city. She looked around at its natural beauty from the clouds to the water and said, we just got to get a connection. And she was able to convince Flagler, early part of 1895, to move his railroad south to the river. It had stopped in 1894 in West Palm Beach.
Tell us about the Cleveland connection, well, and the formation of the city of Miami.
Sure. The Cleveland connection is important.
Cleveland, Ohio.
Cleveland, obviously. Ohio, of course. Julia hailed from Cleveland, and Julia came down to visit her parents for the first time in early March, if you can imagine this, how beautiful it is in early March down here, of 1875, and probably fell in love with the place. Went back home. At that point, she already had two young children. Her husband was a prominent factory owner, industrialist. He later died of tuberculosis. She came down periodically, and her folks were homesteading out in today's Miami Shores, and made a determination somewhere along the way, once her kids were getting up and out, that she'd like to live down here. Bought the property downtown in 1887 for an undisclosed sum of money. It'd be 640 acres. Moved down with the two children. Now they're very young adults, about 21 and 19, something like that, in 1891, November 13th. And she was restless. It was so isolated. She just knew it had to have a connection other than sailboats for the population to really fill in. And that's where Flagler comes in. She struck out with James Ingram, who was developing parts of other parts of Florida, including the West Coast. The connection is that James Ingram, who had worked with Henry Plant on the West Coast, had moved over to the Flagler organization. And she knew Ingram from Cleveland. She also knew John Rockefeller. They had shared
from Cleveland.
They had shared apparently a parish church, and she even told Rockefeller one day, this place will be something. I just want to tell you about this. But Ingram then becomes her point person, and she sends up the fabled orange blossoms undamaged.
Is that a legend, or
it's I think it's pretty factual, because James Ingram, in his late life, and he was still alert about 1920, talked about this before the Miami Woman's Club. He gave a talk there, and he talked about the orange blossoms, that he shepherded those up to Mr. Flagler as proof that these great freezes of Christmas Eve of 94, early February 95, had not reached Miami because these were undamaged orange blossoms.
Tell us about the African American influence on early Miami.
Very strong. Really built early Miami, from streets to pipeline to the construction of buildings to helping Miami incorporate as a city. You needed in 1896 at the time of incorporation, according to Florida state statute, 300 registered voters, and many of them were signed up to register by John Sewell, who was one of the project leaders for the East.
So they voted on the city charter, the African Americans.
They certainly did. More than a third of the city charter voters were African Americans.
Hmm. Let's touch a little bit also on the world. Talk about World War II and the city of Miami.
A very exciting period, Joe. It was a armed forces camp for hundreds of thousands of people, a training camp. The Army, Air Force, men and women took over Miami Beach. The Navy, including not just American sailors, but Chinese and Soviet sailors, took over the downtown bayfront. The Army controlled much of the airport. There were two naval air stations, including a reconnaissance station. There were just primarily men, but also some women in uniform throughout the area for almost 4 years. And they radically changed it. Their spending really helped the economy. But B, many of them got, as Damon Runyon once said, sand in their shoes and returned after the war to become permanent residents. And that fed this just ratcheting population of not only Miami, but South Florida.
I suppose that the development of air conditioning in the 1950s had an impact. This place could be livable.
It did. It had a tremendous impact, not just for, say, a resident, but also commercially for hotels and restaurants and theaters and all. It became more comfortable, and people went out and did business in those venues.
I'm always amazed by seeing the old pictures, say, of old-time Flagler Street in the early days of Miami. And the older gentlemen are wearing jackets and stiff collars. It must have been unbearable.
Just unbearable. The only
of course, the architecture was designed for that temperature.
Well, they had those open arcades, but they didn't have hardly any trees on the street. And that's a big cry on the part of the Miami Metropolis, the first newspaper in 1900. Listen, we've got this really intense sun. We need to plant shade trees along our main streets. Didn't do very much of it, unfortunately. And yet, ironically, the area was just such a wonderful series of trees, subtropical hammocks, piney woods, what have you. But we felled all those things in order to build this city.
Of course, the development of South Florida early on really stayed with the coastal ridge.
You had to. You couldn't go too far west.
Which had
in the
pine,
wetlands.
Which had the famous Dade County pine.
Right. As you move a little bit inland, you hit the piney woods, say the Rhodes neighborhood of today, for example.
And what about Dade County pine? I think your house has
it is, and you've been over there. I'll tell you how durable. First of all, it's not impervious to termites. I've had tents on the house three times in the last 20-plus years.
But it's harder than oak.
It is incredibly durable. We had somebody build some bookshelves for us in the living room, and when he cut through the pine, the house was built in 21. He cut through the pine about 2001. Sap oozed out. That's 80 years later. Yes. So it's a very tough wood. And we felled most of those trees. What you see today primarily are what we call slash pine, not as mature and as big as a Dade County pine.
When was the street grid changed from letters to then the numbers and the northwest, southwest grids? And
the
such?
Late fall of 1920, a man named Josiah Shaley, who was a city councilman for the city of Miami, was charged with that. And that's when it was adopted. And they started counting off from the most important intersection of all of Dade County at the time, Miami Avenue and Flagler. East, west, so south, north.
So yes. Southeast is the smallest quadrant.
Yes, it is, because the bay runs up against it, as is just straight east.
Now, tell me more about the founding of a Bayfront Park and its importance.
Well, Bayfront Park's all landfill. What happened was we had an unofficial...
So the bay came up to where the boulevard is now?
Yes, to a portion of the eastern lanes of the boulevard. And in the early 20s, we began to dredge that bay bottom and created that big park, which is close to 40 acres. We'd had informally a city park, Royal Palm Park, but it was owned by the Royal Palm Flagler interests. So by the beginning of the 20s and even earlier, the city said, we need our own park, just in the event that we don't have this someday. And that's when they began to create Bayfront Park.
I wish I could have been there beyond Flagler Street with nothing to impede your view of that beautiful bay.
And not only impede your view from the shoreline, there were no islands in the bay with the exception in that area of downtown, the exception of Belle Isle, then known as Bull Isle. So you look right across that bay, very shallow and gorgeous, to an unnamed peninsula, today's Miami Beach, which becomes an island when a cut's made at Baker's Hall over in the 20s.
And government cuts history?
Government cuts fascinating. Flagler had built a channel all the way up to Key Biscayne, and That didn't work well. Decided just to cut a straight line from the shoreline out to deep water. Early 1900s.
Well, let's cut a straight line. We're talking about our history tidbits with Dr. Paul George. We're going to take a short pledge break and be back with more. Please be generous. Support regional and local programs.
It's really true how nothing matters. No mad, mad world and no mad hatters. No one's pitching cause there ain't no batters in Coconut Grove. Don't bar the door, there's no one coming. The ocean's roar will dull the drumming of any city thoughts or city way. The ocean breeze is cool, my mind. The salty days are hers and mine, just to do what we want her.
Tonight this is an artist who played in some of the old clubs in Coconut Grove in the 60s.
The stars until sun.
Can you name him?
What would be the gaslight? Candlelight.
It's all from hell.
No, I mean the artist.
Just which way your head is blowing. Who's always
he's trying to whisper in front of a microphone. And you're right, Paul. That's John Sebastian. The song called Coconut Grove. And we're going to discuss Grand Coconut Grove in a little while. I know one time I was interviewing Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. And she was telling me that when she first moved here, of course, to work for her father, Frank Stoneman, that the what is now U.S. 1 was a dirt road between the city of Miami and Coconut Grove.
It was, indeed. It's it's.
Can you imagine that going in rush hour traffic now?
Well, it's bad enough as it is. Can you imagine that? Hey, yay, yay. It's right-of-way followed the FEC railways right-of-way. That's why it's where it is.
And, of course, Coconut Grove is actually older than the city of Miami, as is Lemon City.
They both are, really, in terms of sort of their modern incarnations. Lemon City goes back to at least the 1870s. Coconut Grove, 1873, the post office, although hardly anybody was there.
That's more than 20 years before the city of Miami
was incorporated. 1896, yeah. Coconut Grove's history is just really rich and textured. An inn opens in the mid-1880s, the Peacock Inn, as we know it.
And that family is still here.
They are. Members of the family are still here. And that was really the jump start for modern Coconut Grove. People came to the inn, fell in love with the place. You know, the ambiance is gorgeous there, even more so before, of course. Water's nearby, weather. And they started building the community, and it was an interesting community. It was a community of artists, writers, naturalists, and then, of course, farmers. And there were lots of Bahamians on both sides of the color line. There were white Bahamians, there were black Bahamians. So much of early Miami is Bahamian-influenced because the Bahamas are so close to here.
Was that the start of its rather Bohemian image that remains even today?
It was, with those early visitors, two titled counts, one of whom was very eccentric and... writers would come later, Kirk Monroe, and he would write in a little hut on his grounds. And it's just a very hip area. His wife was a naturalist, sometimes turned her back to the camera, didn't like photographs. You know, those kinds of creative people.
And also the Commodore.
Ralph Monroe, really sort of
a... Not related.
No, not related, but very good friends. They both were founders of the Biscayne Bay Yacht Club, which is the oldest institution still going on in Dade County. Ralph came down from, he grew up in Long Island, but living on Staten Island, came down here over a period of many years, beginning in the late 1870s, and fell in love with the area. Bought in Coconut Grove, gave away some of his land in Coconut Grove to further encourage people to come, and built in Coconut Grove the Great Barnacle. That's the oldest house in Miami-Dade County on its original location, 1891, and other parts 1908.
And where is that again?
Barnacles on Main Highway.
Oh, yeah,
it's a state park.
Right.
You know, just a wonderful place. Walking through
across
that
across from where the old tourists used to be.
Exactly. Exactly.
And you can take tours of that for...
I think it's all of $2 or something like that. Yeah. It's just terrific.
Of course, Ralph Monroe was a tremendous boat designer.
Shallow draft sailboats. You need shallow draft.
Did he make
waters.
His fortune in the pencil industry?
His grandfather marketed the lead pencil. Yeah. So he had quite a... Ralph was engaged in a lot of different businesses. One of the great ones, of course, was designing those shallow draft sailboats, and he was just skilled a lot of that stuff.
And, of course, many of the Old Grove homes were designed to be on stilts, so, of course, it had airflow underneath, and facing the bay to get the bay breezes.
The southeasterly coming in, cooled them off a lot.
We had one relative, descendant of one of the relatives who had been in some of these, who had lived at the Barnacle.
Oh.
And he was on by phone, and he said, well, I was talking about how that was designed to be cool, and he kind of had a southern accent. He said, well, I was there, and it was hot as Hades.
Well, I've been misleading people for a long time then about how cool it was.
I guess it was still compared to today's building, which doesn't, which, of course, depends on air conditioning.
Right. September, October here would be kind of hard. September, August here would be kind of hard to make any place cool other than air conditioning.
I guess that's, of course, that's why South Florida's had always such a big connection to the Carolinas, where people, if they could afford to, would get the heck out of here.
And boy, they did early on. You know, we had Miamians up there in the mountains at the end of the 19th century, and Fort Lauderdaleans soon after that.
Tell us a little bit more about the development of probably one of the key events in Coconut Grove, and that would be the Arts Festival. It was spawned by Charlie Cinnamon promoting one of the plays at the Coconut Grove Playhouse.
Way back in 1963, Irma LaDuce was playing there, and Charlie said, listen, we got a lot of artists in this community. Why not create a left
like
bank?
Like a street scene.
Across from the Playhouse, a left bank, invite the artists to bring their wares out, and they were surprised by the many thousands of people who showed up and decided to go for a second year the following year, and the rest is history.
It's tremendously packed now. Now we even have to, you know, they charge.
Before, the admission fee is $15, and it's still packed. It's amazing.
For many years, we had a booth down there at the Coconut Grove giving out program guides and trying to sell memberships and that. It was always fun. Got to meet a lot of great people.
It's a great event. For me, the Monday of the Coconut Grove Festival, for me, is the beginning of spring in Miami, third week in February.
Let's touch a little more on the commercial side of Coconut Grove. Of course, the restaurants and the stores, theaters, and also what is the status currently on with the Coconut Grove Playhouse?
Coming back, hopefully we'll reopen within a year or so. You've got the state kind of bringing the county back and a couple of acting venues that'll help put it together again. It looks like finally we may see the light of day there, and that has really been a blow to the Grove. It's been closed for over 8 years. And it's the ball's just been passed back and forth, but it looks like it's going to come back.
Of course, there have been the addition of many condos and high-rises in Coconut Grove. I wonder what the feeling of the old-time Groveites are, the ones that used to hang out at the Taurus.
Well, their numbers have dwindled, but I think those who are still around will say, we've been sold out. This place is a lot different, but it still has a lot of charm, though.
And you always go to the Mangrove Strut, which was
I wouldn't miss that. You know, people like Richard Ives and others in there. I think it's just fantastic.
For those of you who haven't aren't familiar with the station, Richard Ives is tall and bald, totally bald, and he plays Governor Rick Scott on one of the floats in the Mango Strut.
He actually plays Scott better than Scott plays himself, I think.
Well, we certainly want to thank you, Paul George. Let's talk a little bit more, though, about the architecture, and also close to Coconut Grove, out the bay, the Stiltsville area.
Right. Stiltsville is really a phenomenon. You know, I conduct tours on a regular basis of Stiltsville, and people are just so intrigued by it.
There's how many are left?
Just seven, but there were at their peak before Hurricane Donna in September 60, 27. Plus, there were clubs out there. I won't tell you what went on there. I mean, it was kind of crazy. But it was a community.
Isn't that where you met your wife?
No, I actually met her at a party.
Out of Stiltsville. But what they were, a lot of fishing.
The fishing's great out there. I mean, you can put a line in the water and there's a bite right away. And so that drew a lot of fishermen out there going back forever. And almost a mythological guy, Crawfish Charlie or Eddie, whatever you want to call him, started selling bait fish out there about 1930 and chowder soon after. And he was a schmoozer, and people came out, would talk with him, and they fished out there. And he sold it off of a beach vessel. And they got the idea, well, if he can do that, why don't we get a beach vessel? They're all running aground in the shallows out there, and we'll just set up like a little shack here, and we can spend the day out here. That's what leads to the birth of Stiltsville in the 1930s.
Well, we've been talking about South Florida history tidbits with Dr. Paul George. Paul, for those who'd like to go on one of your patented tours, what's the information?
Please have them call History Miami at 305-375-1621. and they can book a tour there.
Okay. Paul George, always good to see you. Let's take another pledge break. We'll be back. And thanks for listening, most especially thanks to those who chose to pledge during Topical Currents. The number 866-247-9576, and also it's easy to pledge online at WLRNradio.org. Tomorrow at 1, Bonnie Berman interviews a mystery guest. He's been a fixture at WLRN for many years. You'll recognize his voice, so I'm told. And now we don the green. On this day in 1756, 258 years ago, St. Patrick's Day is first celebrated in New York City at the Crown and Thistle Tavern. The city's St. Pat's Parade began in 1762. And on this day in 1944, 70 years ago, the birth of comedian and director Danny DeVito in Neptune, New Jersey. His South Miami Beach restaurant, DeVito's, closed 3 years ago. Please make your pledge. And one more while we tip the tam for Town Hall tonight. A forerunner of The Tonight Show, Laugh-In, and Saturday Night Live. On this day in 1956, 58 years ago, the death of acerbic comedian and one-time bad juggler, Fred Allen. He had a famous fake feud with Jack Benny for 10 years. Said Allen, "The man next door has bought pigs. We just got wind of it." So we leave with a thought from Winston Churchill on this St. Patrick's Day. When the water in the Chicago River is dyed green. Quote from Churchill, "We have always found the Irish a bit odd. They refuse to be English." Please make that pledge for regional and local programming. Joseph Cooper for Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned for Here and Now next from NPR News.